ground rules. In the first instance, we want to ensure that anyone who's not from SAMAF would let the committee secretary know, because we're only aware that SAMAF is here and PMG, the Parliamentary Monitoring Committee, PMC. Those are the only two we're aware of. Oh, ECIC, yes, as well. Sorry about that. That's what jet lag does. Can't read the rest of the agenda. So we're aware of that. And so you're PMC, are you? We just have become more aware in the last month or so that we need to ensure that we do have a record of people here, even those who are not members of the committee, and that only members of the committee should be sitting around the table. In other words, this part. So that becomes quite clear what the situation is, and of course, those who are directly engaging with the committee itself. But having said that, I would formally like to thank the whip of this committee, the Honourable Chris Ntuli, who chaired the committee in my absence and career while I was attending the aeronautical global conference there. Well, a very important one, the 60th one, and notwithstanding all the other issues of space exploration, this one has also been linked to climate change and, of course, peaceful development. So we really would like to extend our appreciation, Honourable Ntuli, for that. Thank you very much. And as we're just checking, we've got Honourable Kotsi here, Honourable Van der Westhuizen here, Honourable Lyon here. Lyon is not here. Where is she? Just Honourable Kamalo is here. Yes, just Honourable Kamalo. Did I not see her earlier? Honourable Lyon. Honourable Lyon. Okay. Do we have an apology from Honourable Lyon? I'll check with the whip in due course. We have Honourable Kamalo here with us this morning. We have Honourable Mapet Mpashlele here, and myself. So that makes, an Honourable Mabaso just there at the little T. Six. And we have apologies for? Bit worried about that. I think we have to do something, a letter. You know, the Honourable Member Kwabasa, who we heard had been so critically injured in a car accident just the day I went to Korea or the day before, I came out of hospital but has just been re-hospitalised last night. So I would certainly appreciate it, I think, and you would agree with me, I'm sure, if we ask the committee secretary to get the name of the hospital and convey by email or fax our wishes for a speedy recovery. Is that an order then from the committee? And yes, Honourable Van der Westhuizen.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for that initiative. But may I also ask that at one or other stage the committee secretary circulates all the contact details of all the members of this committee, so that if we want to make direct contact with such a person, which I think you won't have a problem, I think you might encourage it even, that we would be able to do so. Thank you.
That's a very good idea, Honourable Cox.
Can I also raise the issue of Freedom Front member? I believe that member is not a member of Parliament anymore.
I see on the list I have you mentally conveyed this to the Secretariat, it was not on my list. So, which list was it on? Yes.
Now, I know it's because the name is still on the list, but officially it has never appeared on the ACC that he has been, we all know, I also know that he has been resigned from Parliament. But until official notification comes through the ACC, they will not change it. So it's a matter that we need to follow up so that they can expedite that so that his name doesn't appear on our, and the smaller party must nominate probably another person in his place in that regard.
Yes, so are there any other apologies?
We also received an apology from Ms. Lubenia, who is being, due to the other party commitments that she, when she returned yesterday, she was informed that she needs to, I think there's a by-election in KZ, and I'm not so sure, and she needs to attend on behalf of her party.
Now, while I do understand that, I hope all parties won't absent themselves in the by-elections, otherwise we'll have to hold our meetings where the by-election is. So, you know, we'll have to have what they call a rolling party meeting or, you know, committee meeting.
Another one. Well, just when I checked my emails, I saw also an apology from Mr. Kubus Marie, who has informed his party website and has got the go ahead to be absent due to other commitments. He didn't detail the commitment.
Honourable members, you know, you can imagine now if the Gauteng contingent or Northern Cape, we'd all be out. But on a more serious note, I'm well aware of the importance of by-elections party politically. And I certainly don't want to, at any stage, cross swords with any other party whip, because I know they would have cleared that with the chief whip, you see. So if this does become a very critical issue, and it may well become so when we do the annual reports past them, we may have to just persuade the respective chief whips to send an alternative along. You know, but that applies both to all parties who are members of this committee, including ourselves. Is that in order? Yes, Honourable Mabaso?
Comrade Chair, I have a task in Gauteng in the afternoon, but late in the afternoon. So that should the meeting go very late, I may ask to leave, but it can't be before lunch. I won't leave before lunch.
What is your idea of lunch, Honourable Mabaso?
1 o'clock.
Then is in line with the agenda. Everyone's idea of lunch is different. You go to Checkers and they're having lunch at 3 o'clock. So we don't know. Right, so yes, sometimes the whole day as well. Can we then move immediately on to Samath, who's been extremely patient? I must congratulate and compliment the department for always being on time and being prepared most of the time. But Samath, now we have the CEO, and I'm going to pronounce this properly, I hope, the Sithembile Masa. Is that right? The CEO. We also have from Samath, is it Miss Mandisa Majesi? Yes. And we have a third person who doesn't appear. Right at the top, HR executive, a very critical person, Miss Nosipho Kweu. I know I haven't got that one right because it's got a click. So apologies for the incorrect pronunciation. The way we'd like to do this, if I see it's 9:45 at the moment or so, is to keep the presentation down to a minimum. I'm sure your colleagues at DTI and the other COTI entities have told you that during our engagement, you actually spend another 45 minutes to an hour. So it's not that we don't want you, but in the presentation, highlight, this is an annual report issue, highlight the critical issues, the challenges, the achievements, the areas that you believe it's possible for us to do something about. So in a way, you preempt some of the more sensitive questions without us trying to dig down. Can we go that route, please? Right. So it's going to be over to you. It is actually 10 to. Shall we try it until 20, let's see, 20 past? Would that be enough time? At the absolute outside. So let's try for 4:15 and then...
So they start now. Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Chairperson. I hope I'll recover those few seconds I lost. Thank you. I think it's important to actually put the context that I'm just going to touch a little bit on the background, the rationale, the mandate, and then go to the highlights, the challenges, and conclusions. Just quickly, if we look at the picture, there was a review of the policy, of the DTI small business policy, and there was a financing gap that was identified from 100 to 10,000 for the very poor survivalist entrepreneurs and the working poor and the hardcore poor destitute. It was found that these destitute and the enterprising poor are actually generating income and they are chasing opportunities, whether it's in the stadiums where they sell or whether they go where there's a road construction and sell and make money. Now, these are the kind of people that then we're talking about. These are their faces. These are the people who have benefited. That's our existence. I thought that I should give that picture so that we can see the people that we are about here. I think it's also important to just look at the mandate of SAMAF, how it is aligned with the government policy and objectives. Because the government policy is to create work, eradicate poverty, reduce inequalities, and expand economic opportunities for all. And that's basically what we're also doing in this particular market for the people that we define as working and enterprising poor. I think the vision is also aligned with the DTI and government vision of broadening participation, equity, and redress in the economy. Also, it's important that the mission and purpose, our mission and purpose is aligned with government policy objectives in terms of poverty alleviation, as I've said, unemployment reduction, job creation, entrepreneurship, and thus therefore ensuring decent work for such people that are doing something for themselves. I think the strategic goals, I'm not going to go through them, and they are part of the annual report. We're always driven by those strategic goals. It's important that I'm not sure whether this is clear now. This thing sounds like cutting as I'm talking.
You can hear, but is it irritating to yourself? I'm not sure. Honorable Mabasa, what's it like down there?
It has been fine to me.
Yeah. Okay.
This thing is also punishing you because of your phone, and you don't see our ages. So your previous point was a bit important. It may be punishing you because you're punishing me.
Okay. Okay. All right, thank you. Okay.
Sorry.
Is that clear now? Okay, good. On the highlights and the graphs that we're going to put, firstly, we're going to present the national footprint and outreach that we've achieved. The question that was asked the last financial year was, why are we not in all the provinces? Because we are not in the Northern Cape in particular. We want to present that we've had that network now. We are in the Northern Cape. We've got nine offices in all the provinces. We've even started to pilot satellite offices in provinces that are wide and widely dispersed, like KZN, Limpopo, Eastern Cape. So we've got nine satellite offices in addition to the offices that we have. We have dispersed on a province-by-province basis to about 42 financial intermediaries, community-based FSCs, financial cooperatives, and the financial developmental financial intermediaries. And each province has produced the numbers that we see: Limpopo 7, Mpumalanga 5, Eastern Cape 5, KZN 4, Gauteng 6, Western Cape 7, Northern Cape 1, Free State 2, Northwest 5. The money that we've dispersed in total is 57 million and it's in the annual report. I don't know why it's a
problem.
Yes, there's a problem. We should be having a picture there. Okay, let me just. Okay, we have since 2006 up to date, the amount that we have approved. In 2006, we approved 55.2 million. In 2006 and 7 and 8, we approved 30.6 million. In 2008 and 9, we approved 10 million. And therefore, in total, it was 96 million that has been approved to date for 42 in financial intermediaries. In terms of disbursement to date versus approvals, as I said, we have approved 96 million of funding and support to financial intermediaries, whether it's financial cooperatives and developmental financial intermediaries, but we've only disbursed 57 million. We have 39 million that is undisbursed. The reason for this undisbursement, non-disbursement, is that we approve funding as a lending institution, and then we reserve those funds. And then the institutions have to draw down the funds, having to comply with Section 38(1)(d) of the PFMA and other sections, because we need to make sure that when we disperse the funds, the financial systems of controls and financial reporting are in place. And so, therefore, once the institutions comply with that, then we disperse the funds. So we are also assisting these institutions so that they draw down on these funds. We've put in place systems to actually assist them. But it's quite slow because institutions take a long time to actually understand that the financial systems of control and reporting are quite critical. We also have some other institutions where there have been mismanagement and corporate governance issues, and so those institutions are on the verge of closing down, and therefore they are taking a long time to draw down the funds. In fact, some of them may not even draw down on the funds of 39 million. I was trying to explain the 39 million that is undisbursed. The grant support and capacity. Grants. In 2006-2007, we disbursed 10.7 million. In 2007 and 8, we disbursed 5.9 million. In 2008 and 9, we disbursed 3.4 million. So in total, just for grant support and capacity, we've disbursed 21 million to these institutions. In terms of the beneficiaries, the people that have benefited, if you look at the faces that I showed earlier, it is those kind of people that have benefited from the program. And the numbers are there. It's 2006 and 7 is 4,000 because we're starting. 2008, we increased the number to 13,000. 2008 and 9, we increased the number to 29,000. In total, we've benefited 47,268 borrowers. And those are the kinds of women and men that I was showing on the picture that have benefited from this program. These people are also mobilizing deposits in their financial services cooperatives. And in the beginning of the program, at the inception in 2006, 14,353 savers, that is themselves, they were saving as members of their cooperative, In 2007, 2008, it was 18,000. They had increased to 18,000. In 2008, 2009, they had reduced to 17,255. The reasons are all there to see, because what happened is that once the remittances from the cities stop actually or are reduced to the households, then the households don't have surplus funds to actually deposit in their own cooperatives. Those are some of the things. It's part of the effects of the financial crisis that is affecting everybody. Loans and access to funding. We have disbursed 9.1 million in the beginning, I mean, at the inception 2006, 2007. In 2007, 2008, we disbursed 18.5 million for loans. In 2008, 2009, we disbursed 9.1 million. In total, the loans that are in the hands of the entrepreneurs that I showed earlier in the picture, it's about 36.7 million. That's the money that has been disbursed that is working out there for the enterprising poor and the working poor community. In terms of loan repayment, we started with a very low base. When we arrived, it was 14% recovery rate. We increased it to 70% recovery rate. We are now at about 40%. And the reason for this drop is also the same as the reasons that we all confronted with in terms of the financial crisis. The sources of income for poor households also have been put under stress like anybody else. There have been high food prices and inflation. There have been low remittances, as I've said, from the cities to the households. And so those remittances are not available to be used to start and repay the loans that people have taken. There's general price increases. And that has affected the poor households and the low-income households, like the financial crisis has affected everybody. Now, I want to slow down when I talk about the challenges and the binding constraints. The first challenge we're facing at SAMAF is the slow uptake and drawdown of the approved funds by the financial intermediaries due to their inability to report adequately in terms of Section 38(1)(d)(1) of the PFMA. This results, therefore, in financial intermediaries getting financially distressed and closing down. Because if they can't draw down the funds and if they can't produce financial statements and ensure that their financial systems in terms of this section, then we are unable to draw down the funds. We have to assist them, and it takes a long time. And so that's the problem that we are facing. So the capacity building is quite critical for us to move the funds. The second problem is that you will note that we've got a technical qualification in the annual financial statement. Because in 2006, 6 months before the end of the year, because we only arrived in October of 2006, we were left with 6 months, we inherited loan agreements that had been there, that had been actually funded. Those contracts were poorly drafted, and they were not in line with the accounting standards 132 and international audit standards 27 in terms of GAAP and IFRS. This resulted in a technical audit qualification in that those loan contracts were seemingly having a control element. The loan contracts were drafted such that SAMAF is supposed to be actually consolidating these financial statements into its own financial statements, so that we're supposed to produce consolidated financial statements, even of community-based institutions. Now, that was not the intention of setting SAMAF. SAMAF was never intended to actually control the institutions that they are supporting. The institutions belong to the people, belong to the communities, but the communities must account and report for the funds that they get. That is the purpose of this development. But however, because of this poorly drafted agreement at the time, the Auditor General found that these loan agreements have an element of control and were supposed to take all the 27 institutions and report them under SAMAF as a consolidated financial statement. We did not do that because we were not intending to do that. So because we did not do that, the Auditor General said we will qualify you. We must also note that the loan agreement had a period of 3.5 years. So we got qualified every year because the loan agreements still exist. They've got a lifetime. What we've tried to do, which I will show later, we've tried to mitigate that risk because at the time the qualification was for 15 million, but we've reduced that qualification to almost 3 million of the control element that we're supposed to report. But I will show at the end what we actually did in action in terms of what. There's also a challenge in terms of the legal framework governing SAMAF. This legal framework governing SAMAF is not adequate, actually, because if you look at the board that we have, it doesn't have fiduciary duties. It only has an advisory role. So every time we have to make decisions, we've got to go to the accounting officer who is managing a big portfolio at DTI, you know, a billion of a portfolio. But then the board cannot make fiduciary decisions. It only just is a mere advisor. This is just an example of an inappropriate legal framework governing a funding institution and a developmental institution. The other one is the PFMA does not give clear powers to SAMAF to litigate defaulting borrowers. The minister in this particular case has to be mentioned because this is a trading entity. We've got to mention the minister as a litigant. And this is not politically and legally tenable. You can imagine if we say a client who has been assisted by SAMAF now defaults, and then we mention the minister now is suing the very same client that, and that is not occurring well in terms of the policy and the legal framework, actually. So that is a challenge that we have. The third one is that we've got an inappropriate and inadequate financial system. Because we are a trading entity, we have to use BAS accounting system, which is a cash-based accounting system. Now, we are a lending entity. We've got borrowers there. We have to disperse funds. We've got to collect funds. And we've got to account the funds according to accrual accounting system. But when we use BAS accounting system, we all always have to do a manual reconciliation, and that leads us to some audit findings of significant findings because the manual reconciliations that have to be done at the end of every year may not be accurate because there's a human factor there. That is a challenge to us. The last one is the policy framework for the developmental microfinance. Specifically in South Africa, if we're going to look at the FSCs, the financial service cooperatives, that we are supporting. These financial cooperatives, in terms of the Cooperative Bank Act, have been excluded on the insurance deposit. What the Cooperative Bank Act says is that in order for the insurance to cover for those deposits of the poor and the working poor in the rural areas and the peri-urban, those institutions must have assets that are more than a million, and they must have members that are more than 200. Now, it means if the FSC is starting up, if Umgalelo or Stokvel is starting up, it means it's not going to benefit from covering the assets of the poor if they are less than 1 million. And I think that is a policy question that needs to be addressed because the Act does not allow it. And for me, I find a contradiction in terms of if the commercial banks have got a deposit insurance when they take deposits, if the cooperative banks have got deposit insurance, but the working poor, when they mobilize their resources and their assets, then they don't have a deposit cover. It's a contradiction. Those are some of the challenges that are facing us, a policy and legal point of view. The last thing I want to say just before I end is that we have also determined that in order for anybody to work at SAMAF, which is the question that was asked from me in the previous financial year, do I have the right people to work in this institution? I did do an analysis of what kind of skills and competences that we want for SAMAF. We have found quite clearly that if you want to work for SAMAF, you've got to have what we call 3-in-1. You've got to have developmental abilities and competences. You've got to identify the opportunities in the rural and peri-urban areas for the communities. You've got to understand that if the government has declared a particular area a nodal point and there's going to be an investment there, you've got to make sure that those opportunities are linked to the people. The second thing, you've got to have financial expertise and competencies because financial discipline is quite important. Corporate governance risk management is very important because these are public funds. But we also say in addition to that, you also have to have social skills and people leadership skills. You've got to lead people, you've got to sit, you've got to be an activist. So we say, if you only have one of these skills, then you are not a SAMAF employee. Because you can't come and tell us that, well, you are a CA only. You only have 33% of the skill. If you are an engineer, you only have 33% of the skill. If you have only development specialists, you've got 33%. You've got to have all of them in one within you. Developmental, financial discipline, and social and people leadership skills. And that's what we've started in the company. The last thing that we've done in terms of the actions that we've taken to mitigate some of the risks that I've pointed out, we have embarked on a training program, especially to develop the 3-in-1, that everybody at SAMAF must be a financial guru, must be a socialist guru, and a people leader, and must be a developmental specialist. We also embarked on the redrafting of those loan agreements that were poorly drafted. We've reduced our exposure from 15 million to date. It's about 3 million in terms of our annual financial statement. So we are gradually reducing that technical audit finding. And it has been found that we've reduced it to 3 million. We hope that by the end of March or in the next financial year, we won't have that technical financial opinion. The third thing, we have appointed independent service providers to do an extensive review of the SAMAF program since inception, 2006 to date, to say what is it that SAMAF did, what lessons have we learned, what are the binding constraints legally, policy-wise, operationally, and what are the solutions to those binding constraints, and how are other wholesale funds or apex funds operating in other countries and even in South Africa if they are, and how are they funded, how are they configured, how are they institutional arranged in order for them to be effective in their work, because these are some of the issues that are confronting us. So we are waiting for that study. That will, a draft report will be coming by the end of November. The last thing that we also did was to report on this absence of the insurance deposit scheme for the working and enterprising poor communities. We've been asked to develop a piece of paper which is going to come into the policy framework in order to move forward this policy gap that we've identified. We remain committed, therefore, to provide financing opportunities for community-based financial intermediaries and to benefit the working poor and enterprising poor communities, as we have shown in the previous picture. Thank you, Chairperson.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Martha. Mr. Martha, before I take the questions, can you just link the statement that was made earlier at the beginning of the presentation of SAMAF being a wholesaling situation for co-op microfinances, and then the next point that you link then up with the cooperatives and other microfinancial organizations, and then the last few points that you then referred to on challenges and binding constraints, and then requesting that the policy framework be changed, and you do a comparison then of yourself to the co-op banks, which does already have that, you see. See, the co-op banks exclude FSC with 1 million and 200 members. So you've got the one there, and I understood you are working with them. So just clarify that for us before we actually get the other questions, please, because that sounds like an important issue we need to understand.
Thank you, Chairperson. I will tackle the one on insurance deposit. I think my Chairperson will tackle the wholesale model, if I may. Thank you. The issue of the cooperatives having the financial cooperatives with assets that are less than 1,200,000 membership bases is a question that I'm saying is a policy gap. Currently, there is a Cooperative Bank Act that has been promulgated. That act is saying the cooperative bank which is it's actually creating a third-tier banking model, because there's commercial banks, then there's this there are building societies, and then this model. Now, what that act is saying, it says if there is a financial cooperative, or there is a Umgalelo indigenous savings scheme, whether we call it a ROCSA, rotating credit and savings scheme, happening in a rural area. If those people are mobilizing deposits, they can mobilize those deposits in terms of the exemption notice number 887. But if those deposits, for some reason or another, there is a virus or a financial crisis which has happened globally, and those deposits disappear or something happens to them, those poor people have got no recourse. Those deposits will not be covered by any insurance. And that's what we're talking about in this. The institutions that we work with are such institutions. Once these institutions achieve deposits and assets of more than a million, then they get taken up to the Cooperative Development Bank Agency that has been created by that act, and they are managed there, and they benefit from insurance deposit schemes if the deposits of such institutions are lost or anything happens to them, or there's a crisis, there's a tsunami or anything, those deposits will be covered by the insurance. What that act says is that for any of the institutions then with less than 1 million deposits and 200 membership, then you are not covered, you are on your own. And I think I just wanted to sharpen that point, because that's the point that I wanted to make it clear. I think the chairperson will deal with the wholesale funding model.
Thank you, chairperson. Good morning, members. I think to tackle this question is to say first, the wholesale model is providing an apex body, that's the outcome, an apex body that would be a provider for loan funds for the on-lenders. So you'd have a network of on-lenders. This network of on-lenders, it would mobilize savings as part of its functions, that is savings mobilization. This network would also provide credit to the end users. But when time comes for cash flow constraints for these lenders, they would need a banker of their own where they could go to augment their cash flow. And then the wholesale model, it provides for that, because it means these lenders would go to SAMAF, and SAMAF would lend them to make sure they keep up their lending streams to the end users. In terms of linkage to the financial services cooperatives and other financial intermediaries, these retail on-lenders, in their form, they are these financial services cooperatives, they are these financial intermediaries. However, what is important now in the context of the presence of the cooperatives agency, in terms of the cooperatives bank agency, is that in the continuum of the existence of these lenders, you have them in a variety in terms of size. They don't start at a point where they have 200 members mobilized. They don't start at a point where they have 1 million capital asset base, which is the entry point of being registered under the Financial Cooperative Agency Bank. So it means SAMAF, as this apex body, becomes that alternative a landing point for all these financial services cooperatives and financial intermediaries, and none other than cooperatives in their form, where they could go to, as I indicated earlier, to augment their financial cash flows to continue on lending.
I'm not sure if you finished there, CEO, this chairperson, is that completion? All right, that's the presentation. I must say you focused quite succinctly on some of the areas we wanted you to. Thank you very much. Yes, we now have an opportunity for questions and comments. We'll take two rounds. So we've got the Honourable Van der Westhuizen, the Honourable Ntuli, and the Honourable Mabaso.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've got what can be seen as four short questions. The first one is there a database of defaulters? I'm afraid that people might be knocking on your door, Kula's door, you know, all the doors, and in the process go from one institution to the other while defaulting on paybacks. The second one is that graph in which you've said that your impairments or your provision now stands at 70%. Does it mean that at present you're only getting back 30% of what you are supposed to recoup, or is my interpretation not correct? Then thirdly, have you taken any legal action? You pointed out that it's very difficult for you because the minister won't stand in court and testify when a loan of 10,000 or 50,000 is involved. But have you instituted any legal action to make sure that there is some form of discipline? And then lastly, how do you try and avoid the difficulty that people can knock on your door without being honest in their expectations or in their plans, and they get the money from you and then they use it for something else? Because if it's true that you must write off such a high percentage of what you make available, then people can start abusing the situation. And you can be accused as well of being just another form of all pay. What do you do to counter that sort of dangerous situation? Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Honourable Ntuli.
Yeah, thanks, Chairperson. Firstly, I want to check who are your main funders? Number two, don't you find yourself between the competing competencies where you want to make profit and at the same time you want to help these people? How do you find yourself in that area? You touch a bit about the qualified and unqualified. How was the Auditor General, last time, did you find the qualified or unqualified audit report in your last, yes. Lastly, is that, as you are saying, that you find it difficult because of the legislation, how can we help you? If you can put forward to the parliamentarians that if we can do 1, 2, 3, you'll be able to be assisted. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Ntuli, Honourable Mabaso.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. My first question has been covered by Comrade Ntuli. The second one is when we go to page 10, slide 10 on page 10, I'll just make sure now. Slide 10. Why are the approvals going down? I would have expected that progressively they should be going up. And then slide 9, related to slide 9. You also assist in an agricultural space. Looking at two areas here, the rural areas under chiefs, as well as the informal settlement, but tied to that also, cooperatives, if you go across the 9 provinces, how many cooperatives are you supporting in each province? But I mean, especially qualitatively, where the successful ones. Then the last one, the 3 critical areas that you spoke of people that must make good SAMAF officials. I assume that also applies to the organizations that you seek to empower, so that the fact that you appreciate this, what mechanisms do you have to ensure that the same streams go to the organizations that you seek to empower?
Honourable Mabasa?
Yes, thank you. Honourable Njikalana?
Thanks, Chair. Apologies for being late. My questions are slide 11. The 2 reasons are given there for the fact that 39 million rand has not been dispersed. The question is, will there be any remedial action thereof? And just an additional question still around that. The FI, how do you get FI? Do you meet them having been established on their own, or is this part of some strategy to establish FI? Slide 18, just linked to Honorable Mabaso's question. Whilst there's been a decline in disbursements and grant support, but there's been an increase in end borrowers, that's an interesting comparison. I may have been late if it was answered, that's fine. But linked to that also, what could be of interest is the average size of loans. I hope I'm not asking for too much. If not, if you can provide it now to your chair, it would be helpful down the line because of the very same question. Admirably, the number of borrowers is increasing, which is what we would like to want. But does the average size of loans remain constant, or does it increase? You know. Slide 14, an area which I know globally is always upheld in this area of financing. But my concern is that there doesn't seem to be visible growth of favor. Any reason for that? Chair, and just the last 2 points, that in terms of challenges and the funding constraints linked to what the Honorable Ndule has said, it might be helpful to have a more detailed presentation on the 6 challenges and constraints so that we can be able to apply our minds. And in terms of the unique sum of employees, where and how do you secure them? Because it doesn't seem that you actually have any. You might be having an easy task to get that kind of people. You know. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Njikalana. Just a few more. You see where I'm struggling to try and fit you in here. On the one hand, we wrote the cooperative banks. You know, we passed that piece of legislation. And at the time, it would be useful to know if you had any concerns at that time about the legislation. You hear where I'm going with this now? Because I don't recall you raising any concerns in, you know, through the entity at all. So has this challenge or these concerns arisen since the passing of that legislation, and why, you see? Because it's always useful if we're going to develop robust legislation to try and get constructive criticism on the draft legislation, you see. The other issue is the, it's still this issue of wholesaling I'm trying to get a clear understanding of. You know, when we were in Atlantis, I would never have dreamt you were wholesaling. You know, it never crossed, a way we were dealing with it, never crossed my mind. I don't know if it did any other member. To me, I was told by the person of your department, somebody who was representing you, that you do deal direct on a one-to-one. So I'm now surprised when I'm learning it's actually wholesaling, you see. So if you can just clarify that, because the one thing I'm concerned with is so many of these agencies are wholesalers. And it's only recently Kula now's got a direct retail platform. So I want to, by the time you leave, I want a totally clear understanding as to where you are on that. The other issue is this, I think the WHIP, the Honourable and Truly raised this issue of the Auditor General's report. You said yourself, you know, everyone seems to agree that there's nothing you can do and... But what can you do? What can you do to get it off the books? You can't say there's nothing you can do, you know. We want to close this matter now. Put it into a legacy document. The other issue is the competence, your employees. Of course, if you're planning to be an upmarket wholesaler for the micros, then it may be understandable. In SAMAF, I saw this as the coalface of the DTI and the micro-lending in a financial institution. And then one looks at some of the countries that have embarked in this area, and they have actually used what we call imperts. I don't know if you know that word. You see, you've heard of experts, haven't you? They're the ones outside. The imperts are the ones in the community who know what's going on. And, you know, they use the inputs, you see. You have specialized knowledge of that. And yes, they may need your training and workshop with routines and, you know, that kind of thing. But I never got the impression, no matter how community-based, as a matter of fact, I got the impression I could be applying for one of these jobs with my 3 degrees. So, you know, I didn't get the impression where you're targeting, or is this indeed a wholesaler that requires something upmarket? You know, where are we, well, what's the level? Where are we pitching this? And I'm not getting a clear understanding on that one. And then, of course, I know you want to be financially sustainable. Worries me when we talk about that, though, because I know on the one hand we had another one of your brothers coming here from DTI who was looking at a profit and balance on the balance sheet and whatever, and I got very worried. So is your aim to kind of make a little bit of a profit on the side to be financially sustainable, or where are you getting, you know, how's this been done? And then one of my last questions is the satellite offices. From what you were saying, I got the impression that the satellites are to address precisely that, you know, in these broadly spread out places, you'll have a little satellite. And then I don't see any in the Northern Cape. So, you know, if you can just explain how that satellite's working in the Northern Cape, or the non-existence of the satellite there. In the Northwest, again, very rural, no satellites there. But, of course, Limpopo, understand they've even been overseas for their co-ops, and they've got 2 satellites. Now, tell me who's got the pull in Limpopo to get you guys there. Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Chairperson. I will tackle some of the questions, and my colleagues will help me on others. I will note what I'm going to take. Let me start with the questions about the defaulters. defaulting in the portfolio of 70%. That was not a portfolio at risk. I was showing the recovery rate. That is, the money that we recover started at 14%, so it was very low. Now we increased the recovery rate. We recover, if we lend 100 rand, we get back 70%, 70 rand of it. And then I'm saying now in this financial year, that the previous financial year, just the last one, it reduced to about 40%. So it means for every rand that we lend, we gave, we recovered only 40 cents of it. Now that means the portfolio risk has been increasing because if we recover 70%, it means 30% was not being recovered. So 30 cents was not being recovered, it's at fault. Now what we're saying now is that 60 cents is not being recovered. Now the question is, what are we doing about that? I think that was the question. So it's not a provision, it's not the money that we've already written off. It's not the money that we've already written off. What we've done is to actually embark on debt collection strategy. And we've taken a number of institutions. Currently we start with mediation because we have to consult them and say, why are you not paying? We follow up. From there, if there are further reasons that makes us panic, then we say, okay, let's go for arbitration or legal. We are at that stage in some of them. But some of them are starting to pay. And the reasons of this 40% that we showed last year are going to change in this year. There's an improvement in terms of the debt collection that we're doing. Because we're using legal strategy, litigation, mitigation, arbitration, and some of the institutions, there's no question about them that we are closing them, so we may not recover those funds. That is the situation we have. We can give a further detail on that, but that is the position. The issue of the legal entity status, we are a trading entity of a department. And so when we sue or when we litigate, we cannot litigate on our own because we are not deemed as having a legal status. So we can't go to court and say, as SAMAF, we are SAMAF, because we don't have a legal status. So we have to say we are an entity of the DTI, and then the court says, but who is DTI? And we say, well, DTI is the DG. And they say, but who else? Where is the minister? We say, oh, okay, the minister is Honorable Mr. Rob Davis. And they say, yes, that's the one who must sue these people. That's what the court is saying. So they say the executive authority is the one that should sue. That takes us into a challenge of meandering through legal issues. And we end up losing the sharpness of our legal pursuit of the interest of government to get the money. By the time you get that particular agreement in the court of law, the borrower has bolted out or something has happened. So it really plans our strategy to get our money. That's the challenge that we're putting on the table. It's a gap. The issue of how sure are we that the funds that we are dispersing are being used for the people for which they are supposed to be. The other issue about double dipping, people coming here and going to Kula and going to NEF, we've got a very specific target market because we're a wholesale fund, which I'm going to explain again. We're a wholesale fund, we work with developmental financial intermediaries. I'll make an example like the Women's Development Bank or business, like the Small Enterprise Foundation. We also start and establish other new entities like a new financial cooperative, whether we talk about Matabata in Limpopo or wherever. But but we've got a number of them. There are 42 of them. So they don't come to us as individuals. They come to us as entities. They come to us as an MFI, RFI, or as an FSC. So they come to us as a board. So when they want money from us, the purpose is to take that money and to unlend it to their own members. We also check, of course, whether they have already established and they are already mobilizing savings. But we have a monitoring program where our provincial managers and our field workers go and monitor every month, and we get reports how the funds have been used that we've dispersed. That is precisely the reason that our disbursements are slow, because once we don't get a report that says the money was used for this purpose and we're satisfied, then that money stays there and is not dispersed until we're satisfied. So we probe further before we move the money again to disperse to a particular institution. That's how robust our monitoring system is. That is how robust our monitoring system is. Now, who is the main funder of SAMAF? Currently, the main funder of SAMAF is government, it's National Treasury. That's the only source of funding. We are not allowed in terms of PMPMA, special section 66, which restricts us from raising capital in other sources. We can't leverage. We can never do that because PMPMA restricts us. Those are some of the restrictions. I don't want to digress, but I may use that as an example, for instance, in terms of benchmarking, and say, if you go to the Grameen Foundation or you go to the PKSF in Bangladesh, when they were funded by government, they were allowed in terms of a regulatory framework, a legislative framework, to use the equity that government put into them and leveraged and get funding from external sources. There was no restriction like we have in terms of the PFMA Section 66. So I'm saying the main funder is government in this particular case. The AG, the Auditor General, and the unqualified or the qualified opinion. I'm just going to be to really explain this. This opinion remains a general opinion because it is not about misuse of funds or anything or mismanagement. The opinion is about agreements that have been written between us and the institutions that we funded. In the agreements, the structure of the agreements says, before you appoint a manager as an FSC, you will ask for permission from SAMAF. Now, that is a control. Says, before you open a bank account, you will ask for SAMAF permission. Now, that is a control in terms of the international accounting standards. Now, that's what the Auditor General pointed to us. Now, what is, and those agreements, because we found the agreements there, the question is, what have we done? I'm answering the other question now, but what have we done about that? The question is, what have we done about that? What we did immediately, we never used those agreements when we arrived and found those 27 agreements. Immediately, when we arrived, we designed agreements that do not have a control. That is why out of 42 institutions that we funded, we are only qualified for 27 institutions only. So that's the first thing we did. The second thing we did was to go back to the 27 institutions and say, you've got to sign new agreements. We've got to renegotiate these new agreements because this agreement that you have has got a control and it is qualifying us. Some institutions, 11 institutions agreed. So we reduced the exposure of the 15 million that I talked about within the 27 institutions. We reduced it to 3 million. Some institutions have closed down. They are no longer existing. We can't negotiate anything with them. Some institutions were still negotiating. We expect that control of 3 million is still going to further go down. The institutions that are about to close, or that have closed, we are in the process of liquidating. because we've got to get a court order that says this institution has been closed down, it's no longer existing, cancel the agreement. We can't cancel the agreement just like that, because constitutionally those people have got a right to rise up again and say, but we had an agreement, wherever they are now. So we've got to go through a process of the court order and get a legal document, which is a court order that says, close down those institutions that have closed down, that you can't trace, that have a control agreement. We are giving you a court order to write them off from your book so that you remove this, so that they are moved out of your book, so you no longer have an element of control. That's what we are doing. And we expect that process to be finished by end of December, because that process is already quite advanced, actually. So that's what we are doing with the opinion, with the legal opinion. By the 1st of April 2010, we won't have that legal opinion, that control element, because these institutions will have been liquidated. Some of them have renegotiated new agreements, and so we've reduced that exposure. We shouldn't have in the next financial statement. So that's what we're doing. I think on the legislation, the chairperson will come in. The question of approval going down, but borrowers going up. If you look at the approvals, in the beginning, they were quite high, 55 million. They went down the following year. But if you look at the borrowers, they were low, and they went up. Because when we disperse the funds, the timing, there's timing differences now in terms of cash flows here. You disperse the funds this year. You approve this year, you disperse the funds. Then the people come in the following year or in their own time, and they borrow from the funds that are already there, because we've got 36 million already that we say ultimately is in the hands of the people. Now, there is a question that is quite a good question about the average size of the loan, because 36 million divided by 47,000, that means an average loan of about 900 rand each. That's basically what it is on average. But that's basically the people that we finance. These people, I'm not saying that each and everyone has got 900 rand, but that's basically an average loan size, because the people that we're talking here about, they buy flour to sell cake, fish cake. So the inputs that they are using, the cost of input that they are using, is not high. They use 500 rand to buy, and they start their businesses. That most of them, because they are quite survivalist and hardcore. So basically, that's it. And that you can, we can benchmark even with the Grameen model. You'll find that people are borrowing 2 takas, 20 takas, which is quite actually far lower than even a rent. And when you compare, so that's the nature of microfinance. Microfinance is not a big loan, but it's for people that take this little loan, but they make big things with a small loan. That's the nature of these entrepreneurs that we're talking about. I think the last one is the sustainability of SAMAF and the satellite office. The sustainability of SAMAF, we're not talking about financial sustainability here. There are elements of sustainability that we are referring to. Because we get the funding from government, we charge only 6% interest. So we only earn 6% interest on those funds. So we're not expecting to be financially sustainable in the sense of making money from the poor and making high interest, because that's not the intention. The intention would be to get that money from government, start to leverage and get other funding sources from donors to bring money, and we leverage with the money. The other intention in terms of sustainability is to build the sustainability of the skills and competencies of the people in the institutions themselves. That's what we're talking about. Governance being there, because you can't measure it in terms of finances. You measure it that there's governance here, things are being properly done. You measure it in terms of financial reporting. You measure it in terms of understanding of the people, by the people themselves, in terms of what opportunities are there that they should take on. That's sustainability. We don't have a clear indicator to measure that, which is a problem. Because when we get audited, we only look only on the financial side instead of also looking at the qualitative capacity building side. Those are some of the indicators that we are still sharpening to say, what is it that means sustainability to SAMAF? Is it funding only? It's not. It's not funding only. It's funding, it's capacity building, it's the capacity of the people to grow what they have. From a social perspective, all the social indicators we should put, access to housing, that's part of it. Education of their children, that's breaking the cycle of poverty. Then we are going to be sustainable because each and every person who got a loan has been able to generate income, send his child to school, and break the cycle of poverty. Those are some of the indicators that we are sharpening in the I think the chairperson will deal with the issue of legislation, and the HR executive will deal with the issue of the competencies of some of the three in one.
Thanks, Chair. I think on the question of legislation, I will deal with two things in the main that were captured in two different questions. One being legislation, contextualizing the legislative context in terms of SAMAF's existence and in terms of the financial cooperative agency bank existence. And then the other element being an element in terms of SAMAF's existence as a wholesale finance institution versus policy directions, maybe as you indicated that there are a number of these wholesale institutions, and again, within the DTI family of institutions, we are beginning to see, as an example, you mentioned Kula saying we are going direct to say, maybe the question there is to say, what keeps SAMAF still being a wholesale lending institution when there is this stance now within the DTI that takes one of the agencies that has been a wholesale financing institution going direct. One, we must remember that the establishment of SAMAF happened as a precursor to the discussions in terms of the establishment of the Financial Services Cooperative Development Agency. And in that case, when, as much as when the bill and the processes to the Act, to the Cooperatives Agency related Act was established, SAMAF was still a very young institution, almost at its inception as well, because it was around about the first year of SAMAF's existence. So even our submissions that we made at that time, they didn't have substantial backing in terms of empirical evidence because we have not yet formalized the lessons on the ground. And as you, as we may all appreciate that, that's a process that would lead with submissions coupled with recommendations, but it's a different level that takes those recommendations and decides on which recommendations are going forward or which recommendations will remain just being recommendations. However, what we did to ensure that at least there is not great of loss of context between the two points in terms of the establishment of SAMAF and the establishment of the Cooperative Development Agency was to ensure that in both processes, we do engage and ensure that the National Treasury is part of the processes. And from the DTI point, that was one of the means of ensuring that as both streams are developing and there is a common understanding from the National Treasury side that was leading the processes of the establishment of the Cooperatives Agency Bank to say what is happening as well within SAMAF. However, we have not stopped there. Now that we have empirical lessons, this is one of the things that has encouraged us to say, let us take now a consolidated picture of what has come out of the existence of SAMAF and make those lessons and make use of those lessons to inform what could come out of the Cooperative Development Agency Bank in ensuring that as that process unfolds now, that institution being a new institution, it is quite well aware of the gaps and the context in terms of what needs to be aligned, linking to the SAMAF that is already in existence. So we are hoping, back to your question, to say what can we do as parliamentarians or legislators to assist in this process. What we are pleading for is to say we need more time to engage first with the portfolio committee as soon as we have our draft evaluation report that the CEO referred to when he was making a presentation, because that evaluation is also looking at both sides, and some of the recommendations are the recommendations that would talk to how do we align now these two pieces now that we have both in place to make sure that everything is streamlined. However, I do want to mention as well that with the issue that is now unfolding in terms of some of the institutions going direct, I'll make it as an example, Kula. There, one of the key things, as an example, that we have been trying to address in the policy framework under the DTI was to ensure that there is an outreach of services to communities where the formal commercial banking sector is not making a visible outreach. However, we have still an interest in ensuring that there is a process that brings into the formal economic mainstream those community-based initiatives, whether called Stockfell, whether called Imigalelo, because we've seen the value of savings mobilization that go into these. But once that is in place, it is not well directed to real economic activities. So some of the presence was to say, let's now nurture these savings mobilization activities at a community level and make sure that they are nurtured, they are given a practice system to develop this as a sector that can be well connected to the mainstream economic activity. So there are two policy imperatives there. One on the other side is driven through Kula, is to say, let's close the gap where the financial commercial institutions, where you are talking of bigger loan size amounts that are required, but there is nothing reaching there. Let's come with our own as government that will reach there. But on the SAMAF side is to say, let's acknowledge that there are initiatives on the ground, but these initiatives, they need to be guided. These initiatives, they need to be given a framework within which to operate. And in that context, these initiatives, they need to be linked appropriately to the mainstream economic activities to enable these communities to participate in the arising economic opportunities that are coming with the development in our economic environment. I think just to touch more again on your question as my last point, where you say it seems as if there is no clarity on the model in terms of this wholesale model. And I think your question there was to say, how do we communicate this and why is it not clear for the people out there that SAMAF is more of a wholesale than a direct lending institution? I think one, the first question is the visibility of the institutions that we work with. As I say, these are local based institutions. These are non-branded, most of them, institutions, if you take your financial services cooperatives. So for them to get legitimacy, they end up using and carrying the SAMAF brand to say, I am Mazombi's financial services cooperative, but to give them a profile, I am a SAMAF institution, and that, in a way, propagates
more of the Sana brand than their own brand. Hence now there is this broader understanding of Sana being an onlender than of Sana being a wholesaler. Thanks.
For your chairperson, I think before I take the three in one, which I think is of interest for anybody, as to how do we get the three in one person. I would just want to answer the first question, which was whether we do have the database of the defaulters. Yes, we do have that database because we do have a system of checking who are the people who are on our database, who are our loanees, and what is their repayment rate, and therefore, at the end of the day, we do conclude as to who are the defaulters and how do we, this is the process we take when we're going to go to say these are the ones which we can take them to impairment and all that, and going to the litigation in some cases. Now, getting to the question which is of interest, it has been asked in different forms. The first question is the mechanism to ensure that the three-in-one have been cascaded from some of to the financial institutions. And the second one is that some of itself, where and how does it secure this three-in-one? And the third element to that question was, has some of gone to a different, has it pitched itself in a different level as opposed to the other microfinance institutions or in the microfinance environment? If we're talking about the three-in-one, these competences, are they the competences of this particular environment or some of it is in a different level? I'll try and answer all those questions at once. The first one is the quick one. Where and how do we secure that person in some of? The truth of the matter is that we don't have really an industry which introduces that person at a go. And how do we secure those people? Certainly, we will not get them in the industry. Now, what we are doing on our own is to say, how do we make it a point that SAMAF does have that three-in-one? I think if we were listening to the presentation earlier on when the CEO was presenting, if we're looking at SAMAF, if we're talking about the financial perspective, now, when we go out there and look at these financial institutions which we're talking about, which we're supporting, how do we appraise them to get to the situation where they get into the gate of SAMAF? How do we make it a point that this particular institution is matching all the criteria which is expected of SAMAF? Then this particular employee from SAMAF has got to have the knowledge of how does that person deal with the due diligence? How does that person analyze the financial statements, the ratios, which will tell this person that this is an institution in which we could make business with. And if there is a gap, where is the gap and how could we close that gap on our side? Now, that is the financial perspective within this particular person. And at the same time, because SAMAF is developmental in nature, which is what is making SAMAF distinct to other microfinance institutions, especially in our South African environment, because SAMAF is dealing with developmental microfinance. Now, the developmental aspect is saying, if you're looking at the enterprising poor of the South African environment, that person does not have the knowledge and the skill of what is he or she getting into. Therefore, the person who's going out there should have the capability and the ability to develop this person to move to a level where this person could graduate to an entrepreneur to the next level. So that is the second element of this particular person. Now, the social element of this person, since this person has got to go to the stock firms and the Magalelos and whatever, how are the people's skills in this person? Because when you are dealing with people, you need to have that. And you need to have that leadership aspect, not necessarily to deal with the day-to-day issues in the office, but at the same time, when you go out there and interact with the communities. So what we have done on our side to make sure that we do have this package of this particular person, because if we're talking about the developmental microfinance, it's not like a consumer lending. You have got this developmental aspect in it. Then we said, let's look at our people. Let's do the profile matching and check if the people do have or if they don't have the skills, what is the gap? Then we are training that internally. which is one of the reasons why, if you're looking at the performance of the institution as well, we have been evolving, because there was no way that we could have had that person at a go. We are moving towards getting that particular person, which answers the question on the financial institutions themselves. We are doing exactly the same thing on them, because before we can support them, we should make it a point that that person is a person who could graduate to a cooler or a cooperative bank and environment. And for that person to grow to that level, that person has got to have the expertise which are expected to operate at that level. That's the reason why we are having this technical support on our side, to make it a point that we ensure that that skill is there. Hence, we've got a capacity building leg within ourselves as farmers. Now, I think to answer the question which came from the chairperson as to how have we pitched farmers, is farmers a different monster in the environment? Why is it needing this 3-person in one? It is answered in what I've just alluded to, that if you're looking at the developmental nature of farmers, that is the reason why we need that 3-in-person. Because if we were just being a bank, we wouldn't be needing a 3-in-person, because that person would just be dealing with the portfolio and saying this person meets the criteria or does not meet the criteria, this person can repay the loan or this person cannot repay the loan. But the developmental aspect of it makes us to say, at the end of the day, we need a 3-in-person. And this 3-in-person is not to be, it's not directed to the people who are on the ground only. The total workforce of farmers, including the support areas, because the support areas cannot support the core business without understanding what makes farmers tick. So I think I've covered that one, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like you to answer just a couple more. We have Honourable Copsey here, please.
Follow-up from some of the response from our the people from the department. I just want to check. I'm not sure whether I missed that. Your staff, some of staff, where do the salary come from? Does it come from your profits, or are they DTI employees? Number two is, earlier you said in terms of litigation, you were relating how it is difficult to litigate because you are SAMAF, and then eventually it transpires that the Minister of Trade and Industry is the one to sue. How then do you deal with the issues of the litigation? You've just related that you are busy liquidating. How do those link? Because you said they are. The other question, you seem to be dealing with millions, but at the end you give 900 rand, or 500 rand, 55 million, and then at the end it is reduced to that, and perhaps how do you deal with that? But Chair, the question I want to ask, which is broad, which I think as a committee we need to be looking at. South Africa suffers from the problem of data in terms of defining unemployment and employment, because nothing is being recorded. These people that are being funded here, what is the contribution? I'm not only talking about SAMA. All these entities that are giving micro, macro loans, especially micro, that's where it is important. What is the overall contribution to the GDP of this country? What is that? And how, what are these institutions like SAMA assisting us in this data that we're lacking in this country? Because identifying people who are unemployed and employed in South Africa is very difficult. But we have these institutions that give loans, and perhaps that they are able to give us a report that these people are employed. But in terms of the data in South Africa, we lack that. how are they assisting this country in terms of cleaning up that area of that information? And that information is, I mean, I want to, the contribution of all this, maybe the DG must assist us. The contribution of all these micro in terms of their, in terms of the GDP of this country.
Just one question to the chair and the CEO there. You know, you've got pages, your performance review here, pages 74 onwards. While you're getting that out, let me just point out in the statistical thing, it's not very helpful to talk about averages at all. In fact, it's very misleading. What I want to know, maybe, you know, it could have been 10,000 and a couple of, you know, a couple of the high bobs and then a couple of the ones right at the bottom. But let's look at the mean. What is this? Because I don't ever want to hear you bringing this term average to us again when you talk about figures, because what you're doing is camouflaging the result. Now give us the facts, all right? The second thing is, now that you're back on 74 onwards, you know, we are very concerned about this, because you look at the performance measures here and your key objectives. In your own words, you want to be a developmental agency and so on. In your own words, a number of things that we all want you to be. And then you have these outrageous targets, which don't even get met 10%, 20%. I'm just looking, 23 FIs, 5 are met, 23 this, 5. You know, I mean, I don't know if the figures here are right, because they're so outrageous. Can you just explain this discrepancy? Who drew up the targets for you? Did someone else draw up your targets? Or the same people that are now telling us what was achieved? I think that's going to be very important. We don't need people to give us fancy targets that have no hope of being reached. None whatsoever. Right. Honourable, sorry, Kamala, Honourable Njikalana.
Thanks, Chairperson. I want to respond to one of the questions from the colleague. You guys cited the issue of monitoring on the borrowers when they default. I just want to check the intention of the monitoring process as to whether is there any mechanism in helping those people that are defaulting, or maybe just after they defaulted, you are just waiting to, for them to be defaulted and then you're taking the legal action. So I'm thinking of that question, Chairperson, because you may go, I mean, to the constituency and let them know about the sum up, only to find that you are putting them in a, in a trouble. That's thanks.
I think it was Honourable Njikalana.
Thanks, Chair. In terms of the footprint and outreach, I see that Gauteng, being a rich province in any case, is still right at the top in terms of disbursement. Of course, my understanding is that the, within the Coty Group, there are attempts to ensure that we shift away from, or if we are biased towards poor provinces. I might have been late, Chair, but I would like to hear that to what extent are you ensuring the bias towards the poor provinces? I do acknowledge you seem to be quite high up in terms of Mpumalanga, but the others are still pretty low down the line. And even the Chair raised the issue of Northern Cape not even being in the radar screen. And, Chair, I must have missed, maybe there's been a lengthy response when it came to why no growth in the number of savers. That's a reference to slide number 14. Chair, I very much support Honourable Kosi's import point about impact assessment, and I would plead if it's agreeable that impact assessment becomes
an annexure in the pilot report, because it's very fundamental. Output are quite fine in terms of performance targets, but we'd like to know the impact, to have an impact on assessment as well. Another small area that might be helpful, Chair, is that given that SAMAF must have been doing a lot of research and surveys and exchanging experiences on a global level, it might be helpful if they could just share with us experiences of other microfinancing institutions, Grameen Bank, Bangosol, BRI, the rest of them, just a little bit, and share it with the rest of us, because for us to understand the world of microfinancing is not just to understand SAMAF on its own, but it's also understanding from a comparative angle, comparing with other models. That also could be very, very helpful. Thanks, Chair.
Yes, I'm afraid we have the enemy of time. Time is not our friend. So what we're going to do, I think, you see, the microfinance, all of this is absolutely critical. We've just scratched the surface here. We certainly, after this, going to have to call you back for a, more of a three-hour engagement. So the questions that have been raised are absolutely critical for a full response before we complete the annual report ourselves. So we're going to ask you to put this in writing to us, please. Friday, if possible. Monday at the latest, so that we've got it before the meetings again on Tuesday. All right? Written response. And obviously, this is all at your fingertips. So just put it down on a paper and then send it to the committee secretary, Mr. Hermans. I'm sure you've got that contact detail. But the issues raised, the extra issues raised by the Honourable Njikalana, I believe, require something like another morning session just on that, and maybe not just yourselves, but others in this little net of microfinance institutions. So let's talk on that issue, because it's just such an important agency. And one, from the performance review, one is alarmed. Honourable Mabasa?
I'm not asking the question in view of time, but also if the answer can include the answer to the question I asked about cooperatives and the breakdown,
There were one or two questions which were not fully responded to. You know, you glimpsed, just a little glimpse over them. Unfortunately, tea was at 11 and is now 20 past 11. So I'll ask members to take a 5-minute tea break before we move into the ECIC. But we do want to thank the chairperson, the CEO, and the human resources person for being here today. But we do hope you'll take the opportunity to really respond to these in writing. And bearing in mind that there are a few anomalies in your annual report as well, which I'm sure you've identified. But I didn't want to waste my time referring to it. Thank you. Just ring him, please. It's important he's here. Right. So, Honourable Mabasa, if you could just take your seat, and then we can get started. Where's the presentation?
Yeah.
And the name? We'd like to welcome the ECRC representatives. We have got three people listed here. Of course, it's very clearly clear to see is that Ms. Sevzani Madal, that's the Chief Financial Officer, and then is a Dr. Patrick Kolo. Is that right yourself, sir? Chief Executive Officer. Now, there's something wrong with that.
That's the way.
Pardon? No, it's really not good. No, could you just come to the next one? That's really quite bad.
I was saying we did send an apology. The chairperson had said his apology that he couldn't make it for today. He had planned to come in on the 13th, but the meeting was moved and he couldn't change his arrangement. I did inform the office quite early. Time yesterday was that.
The meeting was moved beyond our control. We do apologize for that. Got the idea as to how we want to do it. Very little time on the presentation and then the engagement.
Precisely. Thanks very much, Chairman. Thanks, Chairman, for the honourable members. I'll start actually just quickly going through the computer as quick as I can to give you Madal a chance also. The plan that you have here to deal with the vision, mission, the mandate, strategic goals, achievements. And then because of a major issue that has come up, why I need us to go through some of these issues, because we would have had a technical qualification had we not done what we have done. This is to do with the new a change in accounting policy in presenting the account in what's called terms financial, a functional currency. So she will explain that, because I've been out of this profession for years, and she's much younger than the first CA, so she knows what's happening in the new international accounting standard. So she will look into the issue of the US dollar financing insurance. It's just a background and the financial performance, and I'll get back to finalize with the challenges. Starting with the vision and mission, our vision as the ECIC is to be at the leading edge of medium long-term export credit and investment insurance business. And our specific focus is on the project finance underwriting, customer needs, and prudent portfolio and risk management. I should have said to say that we may have to relook that vision, looking at how things are setting out now with the new economic downturn and meltdown. This is not going to persist. We have to start changing. We can't sit in a little box and not change. As I say, you have to change, master. If you don't change, you die. So we may have to adapt here at some stage, and I'm just saying to the committee, this vision may have to be relooked at given the circumstances internationally around us. And our mission is to facilitate and encourage South African export trade by underwriting export credit loans and investments outside the country in order to enable South African contractors to win capital goods and services contracts in other countries. Now, in order to support this mission, we evaluate export credit and foreign investment risks, and we provide export credit and foreign investment insurance cover on behalf of the government. We focus on underwriting of medium and long-term loans and equity investments for the export of capital goods and services from South Africa to foreign countries. And we extend our services as far as we can, consistent with preserving the financial viability that is essential for us to have a long-term support of exporters of capital goods and services. And in doing so also, we provide sound and efficient financial services that contribute to public confidence and comply with international standards. Now, I'll quickly just go into our mandate. Our mandate in terms of the Act is to provide insurance, and I've highlighted it on behalf of government, on contracts in connection with export transactions, foreign investments and loans, or similar facilities that relate to capital goods and services. The reason why the insurance market or the export of capital goods and contracts are the banks mainly. We're not happy with us just providing insurance. They wanted us to do it on behalf of government because of the balance sheet that we had would not be able to sustain a situation, doomsday scenario. The sense of it is that we do contracts you know, of multi-million, sometimes of billions, over periods that start from 3 to 10 years, sometimes to 15 years. Now, if we had about 30, 50 of those kind of projects, there's no way our balance sheet would have been to maintain that. So nobody was prepared to do business with us until we could prove that we'll do it on behalf of government. So actually, we did have to go back to Parliament to have the act changed to insert that those few words on behalf of government. It's just a bit of back.
Export Trade and Investment Guarantee Act.
Yeah, as I was saying, now we were actually pressurized to do that, but it makes good sense because if there's a run of if a run of the bank on us, we would not be able to finance that. So if the clock does tick, we have to pick up the red phone. Though I know when we started this in the Minister of Finance, then Minister of Finance, Mr. Germanuel, says he calls me Toppy. Says Toppy, you must never pick up that red phone. And don't call me because I've given you all the money. They gave us $2 billion, and I've not gone back to ask them. But I don't know. One can never know in insurance; it's all risk. So anything can happen at any time. And the banks are quite justified, actually, to request that kind of thing. So we despite the fact that we are insuring on behalf of government, we still have a responsibility as a corporation. That is why you look to see that for 9 years that we've been there, we've never had a qualified report, and that means we're still doing things the way they're supposed to be because we're taking a risk. Oriented focus on our business. Now, the essence of our mandate is really we're doing business that nobody wants to do, and the government believes that if we have to promote our exports, they have to come in and fill that gap. So the essence of mandate is that we're filling the market gap between the requirements of the capital goods exporters, investors, and the capacity and appetite of private sector insurance to provide such insurance, especially in respect to medium long-term political risk events that go up to 15 years. And I may highlight that we don't do short-term insurance. We do medium-long-term. So, and this is when we were formed out of the insurance fund that we have. We used to use Credit Guarantee Insurance Corporation as the insurer, and government with a fund that is an insurance fund actually reinsured CGIC. But then it was clear that CGIC did not have the real interest of government in the sense that you didn't expect a private company to actually execute government policies. So the government decided to actually privatize the short-term part of the business and keep the medium long-term, which nobody can do or nobody wishes to do as a capital to do. So this is just the background that sort of people are clear as to what we're doing. So we don't do commodities. But I'll have a point at the end where I have a little recommendation to make to the committee on the issue of the short-term, given the changing nature of the economy and the world. Political situation. Now, our strategic goals, which are also in the annual report, I'll just quickly go through them. It's a focus on customers. We provide high quality. Our key thing is to provide high quality services to all clients, including manufacturing exporters, export contractors, financial institutions, investors, host country authorities, and buyers. The next one is to enhancing performance. We are committed to building a high performance organization, which operates on an effective and self-sustaining basis through prudent underwriting and sound risk management practices. This is the cornerstone of how we operate, and this is very key. You'll see in every thing that we discuss, we always look at things from a risk perspective. Even if we look at challenges, we see challenges as a risk. The next one is engaging in strategic alliances. This is also fundamental. You cannot work, men cannot work as an island. We're forging partnerships and alliances. Engaging with, we forge partners and alliances with insurers and government agencies and also international organizations so that we can complement and leverage all our resources. And the fostering risk orientation, we create an enterprise-wide risk awareness. And this is also a very key area of how we operate, so that we have effective risk management techniques. And also providing effective stewardship. So we have to provide leadership here in terms of us using sound business, environmental and social principles, and also in that respect applying international best practice. Now, our achievements in terms of the strategic goals that we've set ourselves. Firstly, on focus on customers, we have conducted comprehensive reviews of insurance policies and conditions. And this has involved some of our major clients and also our potential customers that we plan to have in the future. We have held our annual client endeavor that we hold in Johannesburg. This includes financial institutions, the IDC, the capital goods exporters, and other parties that we feel relevant to us. We do that every year, and it's a very important one because it brings in clients, it brings all the people that we deal with, so they can we report to them what we've done in terms of policy changes, and also we get feedback from them as to what they is required, but what they feel they require from us in future in making changes. And we continue to create awareness of our products through various workshops. We've held some in Cape Town, in Durban, with export councils, with capital goods manufacturers, and so forth. We also participate in the annual mining Durban Cape Town as an exhibitor. Now, the annual mining Durban is attended by all the international players. It happens every year, and most of the time it's held in Cape Town. We've decided to go in as an exhibitor. And enhancing performance, we have developed a UPP methodology, which is an earned premium provision, which has been approved by our insurance regulator, which is the Financial Services Board. We've also had the methodologies for our portfolio concentration risk and also for our reserving for unannualized premiums, which has been reviewed and has been approved by the Financial Services Board, the insurance regulator. However, with respect to the concentration risk model, which has been approved by FSB, this has not been entirely acceptable to the South African Revenue Services, basically on tax issues, because with any provision, we want to claim that against our profits, and they reject some of it. So we'll keep negotiating with them. We've also developed an internal minimum capital requirement model, which has also basically been approved by the FSB, but they have not actually approved the model per se. They have approved the standards that we have set. So probably down the line, when it's finished, they may turn back and say, no, we don't accept it. But at that moment, they're quite happy with the approach methodology. They may not approve the approach. So I'm not claiming here that it has been approved. It is just that the approach is acceptable to the Financial Services Board. The other achievement that we've made is in engaging in strategic alliances. We actively participate in the Bern Union Committee, and which deal with investment insurance and medium-term credit insurance. We also have signed the cooperation agreements with Arcadia in Netherlands, and we have hosted the Bern Union seminar entitled Doing Business in Africa, which was attended by representatives from 15 countries. Now, this is the first time that this Bern Union has actually hosted this kind of meeting in Africa. We have continued to participate in the OECD deliberations as observers, in their working committee on export credits and credit guarantees, and also in the premium group. We interact on a regular basis with our export councils, with various institutions such as the DBSA, Development Bank of South Africa, with the NEFED Business Council, with the Universal Johannesburg, which is a special department that deals with export credit insurance, and also with the Electoral Institute of South Africa. One may wonder why we're dealing with the Electoral Institute. It's mainly because they collect a lot of information on various countries for electoral purposes, but we use those databases from a political risk perspective. So we find they're a very good partner because we use quite a lot of information to be able to do our political risk analysis, we tend not to want to depend on foreign publications the World Bank. They do depth research, and you can't depend on that. So we use a whole variety of sources for information, and where else would you get it rather than from an institution of high repute such as the Electoral Institute of South Africa? So they work with a correct policy section to share information on risk so we can put all those things together. Fostering risk orientation. We have a whole host of risks that we identify in the company.
Now, we have identified nine that we have elevated to the executive level. That is those that are managed by senior management. And we have a host of others that are managed at the operational level. But if it gets quite, we feel that it's becoming very, very risky, we elevate it to the level. So we have nine of them that we have identified, and we monitor this on a monthly basis, and we report on these on a quarterly basis to the board. We have focused also now, because of the international turmoil, on credit default risk. Basically, because we have to look to see that we ensure that we can manage credit default risk. The reason for it is that a lot of companies are facing a disaster, and in a sense that they're going into liquidation. We have to make sure that the process that we have are timeously looked into to make sure that we can put in mechanisms that can reduce the risk, not actually avoid it as insurers. So it's a risk mitigation process that we are doing. We also have the issue of our actuarial analysis. The insurance regulator requires us to do an actuarial analysis every 2 years. But we find that 2 years is a bit too late. So what we've done, in the interim, we've engaged with our actuaries to do it on an annual basis. That, in a sense, helps us to be able to provide for the risks that we see rather than wait for 2 years to come. So it was better earlier than later. So it's working much better that we can properly, on a yearly basis, provide for actuarial risk. And then we also have to mention a success here is we have a project in Mozambique, mainly the Mozal, which is a 2 billion operation. Now that is also, this is on the reinsurance. We inherited this particular one. Now with this particular one, it is coming down very, very, very quickly. It was 8.4% the previous year, and it's come down to 32.04 at the end of the financial year. This is a very good watch call. The reinsurance portfolio goes down, and the insurance portfolio is moving up. So we feel this is a wonderful event we've done. And providing effective leadership, we deal in many countries in the world, and our legal system is different from other legal systems. So what we also do to make sure that we cover ourselves is to continually review legal review of the laws of countries where we operate, so that we make sure that we can understand when we deal with them that if something goes wrong, we can be able to go and salvage because of the laws that are different. We've started also developing a carbon footprint policy to encourage employees to make responsible use of resources. We participated. We have actually sort of, with this particular last annual report, we have done it on we printed on SEPI triple green paper, which is environmentally friendly. We've also employed resources to actively enhance our asset management procurement practices and also in our competitive resourcing. With regard to employees, we conduct a quarterly personal development planning reviews that has to look at the people's skills, the succession planning, and to see exactly what other mechanisms can we use to intervene, because we're a very small company, our resources, the skills that we require are very scarce to find, so we use those mechanisms to do that. And in it also, we do what we call cross-training. You know, we don't find people that have all the qualities that we require, as much as we can wish. So we have to develop those skills within the corporation. If you're a lawyer, you can damn sure be sure that you're going to actually learn how to become an accountant, you're going to learn how to become a financial analyst, and also how to become an economist within the period of 3 years. The sad thing is at the end of the 3 years, we lose everyone that we've trained for that period because they're better than when they came in. Probably they should be going to summer because they have all the qualities that they require that we have developed. We undertook a detailed internal restructuring exercise. This is also because of the global disaster that we had, that we have to restructure. And we've restructured three operational units, which we have downsized to subunits because we find that because of the training that we're doing, we actually had freeloaders. The basis was to create more capacity in case people leave, but we found that it's not going to help us because we don't have quite a lot of projects at the moment. So we downsized. Some managers became supervisors, and some supervisors became line operators. So it didn't quite go well, but we didn't fire anybody. But some people didn't like to be downsized. They decided to leave on their own. So it's not that we really wanted them to leave. I think I'll stop there for a minute to give Ms. Modal a chance to get into her financial performance.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. I think as already indicated,
in our business, it's like that. We've moved towards dollar pricing. In other words, our premiums are charged in dollars. And in the next few slides, I'll basically explain the background in what resulted into that, because in the current financial year, it had an impact in our financial results, because international accounting standards required that we change our functional currency from South African rand to US dollars. In the first slide, it's basically the fact that we are insurers in an export finance industry. It's such that most of the financing is provided in hard currency, in which in this particular case, it's the US dollar. And hence, from 2003, the ECIC has gone towards underwriting projects which are in US dollars, and as well, we've also gotten an approval from the Minister of Finance at that particular time. I was already indicating the fact that we underwrite projects which are financed in dollars, and hence that forced us to move towards then charging premiums also in dollars, because that means that we're inheriting liabilities that were in dollars, securities that were also in dollars. So from 2003, with the approval that we got from the Minister of Finance, and also the fact that the Reserve Bank as well has also given us authority, we provide FEC cover, which are only in dollars. So as the ECIC, we are underwriting projects in dollars and also pricing in dollars. Now, up until last year, the RAND portfolio that was inherited from Credit Guarantee, as Dr. Polo had mentioned, was still significant when you look at the total portfolio. Now, up until last year, it was such that the dollar portfolio had become much more significant, in the sense of most premiums that we're receiving were from the dollar source, and less premiums from the rand source. Now, according to the international accounting standards and also the SA GAAP, we are required in that particular instance to use a functional currency that dominates our revenue, because what it says is the fact that we should use a functional currency of the economic environment in which the entity trades. And one of the tests that are applied in terms of the economic environment which influences the environment where the entity is trading is what sort of the revenue source, what sort of currency is dominating the revenue, of which from last year, the ECIC, a significant portion of our revenue and even a significant portion of our liabilities and also assets were then dominated in US dollar. So we are then required to change our functional currency from the US dollar to from the rand to the functional currency, because it's actually for accounting purposes, you're supposed to have, there's two currencies. You have the functional currency and you also have the presentation currency. Now, being a South African company, state-owned, and also our shareholder being the DTI, it was said that we can't possibly change the presentation currency. So what has happened is the fact that our functional currency is in rand, but presentation is functional currency is in dollar, and presentation is in rand. That's why I have reflected in the financials. And I also like to refer you to page 48 on the financial. I was on the slide. On page 48, that's where we showed, we explained the whole change. Now, some of the benefits of this US dollar financing that the ECIC is involved in is the fact that, away from the balance of payment, the fact that there's inflows and outflows of this dollar out of the country, because international buyers are paying back into the country in US dollars. So it's impacting positively in that respect. Now, because of that particular move that was made from 2003, we have now changed. And this particular change that we have made in the current year has made a significant impact. And as I was indicating in accounting policy number 3 on page 48 of the financials, we showed how that particular impact is. Just to also indicate that in the SADC region, we do sort of like influence buyers to use rent financing. I'll now move to financial highlights. In the current financial year, our gross premium has reduced by 21%, and that was mainly because we didn't have the IMU incentive available for the whole financial year. And hence, because of that, we didn't underwrite as much projects as we would have if we had the particular incentive available. And also, the claims that we paid out in the current year has increased by around 104%, and that is mainly because, obviously, especially with a downturn in the market, a lot of projects are in distress, and hence claims are being presented to us. And I also like to highlight also the increase in the insurance portfolio. The fact that there's a 12.4%. A significant portion of that 12.4% is not actual growth in the portfolio. It was the fact that at the end of March, the rand to dollar rate had weakened compared to last year. And then the actual growth in the portfolio was actually 0.38%. That's why it also linked with the fact that our premium is down, because there was not an actual growth in the portfolio. I would now like to move to our actual performance against the budget. Now, we prepared these three columns to basically show. The first column is the approved budget in rand. Anything here is in rand. The second column is the actual financial results in rand, because with the change that happened right now of functional currency, we actually had to do the rand financial statements, because SARS does not entertain the whole functional currency change, because that's an accounting aspect. And just to highlight on this particular table is the fact that in terms of our performance against the approved budget, we performed well, because our profit before tax is actually 64% above what the approved budget was. And that was mainly because our investments that we have advanced very well, and also in terms of the concentration methodology that you mentioned now, which was introduced last year. In the current year, it was such that because of the improvement in the concentration of risk, like you mentioned, in Mozambique and also in Iran, that resulted in the concentration risk provision reducing. And hence, on the income statement, it had a positive impact. So in terms of rand performance, which in other words
the middle column, if there was no functional currency change, this is what would have been published right now on the financials. But right now on the financials was published as the last column, which is the USD functional currency table, because now we are now on functional currency as required by international accounting standards, of which that brought about in the on the profit before tax, it resulted in a decrease of around 293. And that again is because when we translated the results and the rand to dollar rate being so weak, it was felt that there were huge losses as reflected there on the foreign. That's right here. Can you hear me better now? Okay. Now, as I was mentioning, is the fact that the last column is what's published in the financials, of which the main difference, because of the change in the functional currency, it has resulted in an overall decrease of our profit before tax of around 293 million. And that is because when we translated with the rent dollar rate having weakened from around 7.73 last year to now, at the end of March it was 8.19, and that meant that we had now made huge losses. So that's the main difference in this particular result. Thank you. I'll now hand over to Dr. Paul.
Okay. Finally, I'd like to look into the challenges that we face. Like I said earlier, we use a risk approach to look at what challenges we have. And the three key ones out of the nine that I've talked about are the ones that are presenting continuous challenges to us. Two of them are internal, and one is sort of external to the corporation. The first one is succession risk. We do not have a problem in finding people to work for us because we are a very specialized agency with a different knowledge base and different way of operation. We're the only ECA in the country, so obviously the skills that we have are not found somewhere else. So we have to train whoever we bring in. Fine, we look at particular standards for people, what level they've achieved in whatever the discipline they've chosen, and we have to train them in the various skills. We don't only train you in the profession, as I've said earlier. If you're a lawyer, you'll end up having finish being a financial analyst. You do a whole lot of things in the company, and that takes a minimum of 3 years to train each and every person in the company. I think that's how much it took me coming out with a PhD and all finance degrees. I had to still to learn within the company. The only problem that we have is once you spend the 3 years training them, the banks actually steal them, because this is where the market is. They work with the people on a daily basis. They pretend to know how good these guys are, and they offer them double what you're paying them. So for you to get them back, you have to offer double what the bank is. So it's pretty much very exponential. So we just sort of say, well, if the write-off will become a trading institution. So this is the risk that we have. It's a succession risk. The other risk that we have is the risk, concentration risk. This is also not by choice. We, as I said, we are in a sense an insurer of last resort. We're filling the market gap. So we don't go and look for business. Business comes to look for us. And also, the business we do, we don't just get, our clients go to tender internationally, so it's not a given that you'll get 10. If you do 10 projects, you're going to win 10. Sometimes out of 10, we win 2. So it is very, very difficult for us to choose where we want to be. Now, as it stands right now, the 34, our portfolio was highly sort of slide over to Mozambique was of 32% and Iran 31.3%. Now, this poses a danger if there's a big, massive problem in Iran. You can imagine 31.3% of 14 billion could be really very serious. But then these are causes that we need to have to do to make sure that we can, you know, it's a trade-off. You want to get your export of capital business services, you have to take the risk, and that's why we provide the insurance. So this is a very, very tricky one. And I think we're going to have one coming up very shortly that will be Zimbabwe, where for national interest, we have to go in there and do business. And I can tell you, everybody in the whole world will never want to take that risk. They'll say, South Africa, come on, you know, NEPAD, you're the leader in the country. Why can't you take some of that? But we'll not be able to carry that. So that's also going to be a bit of a risk. Especially if you look at it also, it's going to mean that our portfolio in Africa is going to be much too high, because we only have a few countries outside Africa. We have Kazakhstan, we've got 2.3%. Turkey, we've got 6.5%. And, you know, other general countries, 3.4%. Very little internationally. Most of it is in Africa. And then a very fundamental one, which I'd like to sort of talk about, is the rough mix associated with the interest makeup. Now, the interest makeup is a so-called, well, it's a subsidy that is given to the exporters to make sure that they can compete very competitively overseas. And we don't own it. We are just managing it on behalf of the DTI. It's a transfer payment that's made by National Treasury to the DTI. And then we manage it on their behalf. It helps us to be able to do business. Now, last year, we did not receive any permission to be able to do it. And that's the reason why we not necessarily because of that, or of the lack of the interest makeup, but also because of the international turmoil that we didn't do very well in last year. But the point I'd like to raise for the committee is that normally we people in the street complain that we have the right to do something, but not the means with which to do it. In our case, we have the means to do something, but not the right to do it. We have money to pay for the interest makeup, but we're not allowed to use it because our what you call was the agreement was not approved by National Treasury. And I'm not here to condemn National Treasury, but I think I'm going to appeal to the committee that at some stage on this issue, they bring in the DTI, National Treasury, and ourselves to debate this issue because we have the money. And if you go to on our annual report, page 70, you'll see that we have half a billion, which we could not use to help our exporters. And I think I don't know if Sarah has passed it on. There was something I called notes for the committee, where I showed that we actually lost half a billion worth of business because National Treasury refused to sign when we had half a billion for a whole year. And part of it, I may say, is because one person leaves, so nobody else knows what's happening at National Treasury by then. But particularly this particular year, we had somebody that came in, and I have never seen something like this in my life. So somebody said, I don't care what you say, I want you to start from scratch. Justify your existence. I mean, we've been 9 years in operation, and we are trying to go and justify why we are here. So I'm pleading with the committee that I've tried to talk to the DTI, I've agreed with the minister, but everybody knows the DTI, National Treasury, crisis, that we are caught in the middle because we can't do. So the country lost half a billion worth of business because somebody in National Treasury refused to sign when it was approved already. So, you know, as I say, we have the means to do it, but not the right to wish to do it. Finally, I want to, this is very personal, and I think my connect, some people think of, because I only have 2 years to go in my contract, I'm being a coward now, and I'm suggesting. I'll keep moving. Hello, hello?
Yes.
Sorry, what was the question?
No,
nobody.
So they say I'm a coward because for 9 years I never came with this kind of recommendation. It's basically because we didn't have experience in the whole business. We started in 2001, and you know, I started with it, it was not in my own field, and we were doing trial and error and trying to sort of set up the whole thing. Now, when the ECIC was formed in...
Look, I need to know what you're saying. All right. Now, I'm totally lost from the last time you spoke about half a billion. Until you said the word contract. So I've lost a lot of information.
No, I thought I'd make clues on this particular one that I need to approach the committee at some stage to intervene to get the DTI, National Treasury, and ourselves, because we had the money to fund this project, but we did not get the permission by the National Treasury to renew the contract.
That's the one.
Yes. Now, here I'm coming now with a recommendation that I'd like to make. That has to do with what we see happening, in the changes that are happening. We are not allowed by legislation to do short-term business, which we, when we started, we were It was privatized. But I believe probably what needs to be done, I don't know how that can be done, is that we, in special cases or where there is national interest, that we should look at maybe using a special mechanism for us to enable us to do short-term business. Like, for instance, in Zimbabwe, you're going to need to do agricultural stuff. They're already making applications to us. But because we are not allowed by the mandate, we're only supposed to do medium long-term. We may, in special cases, that can be ring-fenced and be given permission to do short-term on probably national interest account or by special permission by the minister. I think the Act has a little bit of a loophole that can allow that, but we have not been able to get that kind of thing. So probably we, with the prompting, and I say this also, I think the member also raised the question at the when we did the budget presentation, whether we could not intervene if, in case of somebody who has done grain or agricultural product, can we cover them? But I think in the case of places like yes, Zimbabwe, we are really going to need to be able to do it because, as I said, foreign countries are not going to want to take a risk in Zimbabwe until we have shown that we can do that. And it will actually improve, do a lot of advantages to our country where we can do the exports. It's just a thought that I have that maybe something that is not impossible to do, but I think probably with a mandate, I mean, that the new government has, poverty alleviation, this is quite an area that probably we could do. I don't know how the private market is going to react to this because we promised them that the reason we're not doing medium long term, there is enough appetite in the market to do short term. So it's something, I don't know, that I'm just putting that we may need to look at. And maybe members can also think about that and see how they can help if we can do it or whether it's a national interest to do so. It's just a personal feeling. It's just that I'm saying it just 2 years before my contract expires, admitting that I'm trying to leave the problem to other people that are coming up. And because obviously it's going to take a bit of time to get that probably legislation through if there is any to be made. But thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Kolo. Right, over to the committee now for their questions and comments. Honourable Mabaso, Honourable Cosby, Honourable Van der Westhuizen. Honourable Njikalana.
No, thanks, Colleague Chair. My question is, to what degree does does ECIC relate to bilateral investment treaty policy framework? You know, in as far as South Africa trades with other countries intra Africa as well as internationally. But then the second point is to what degree are the national players aware of ECIC so that we don't have a problem where other players who might be ignorant of your existence and what you stand to offer lose out on the basis of not knowing what you are availing. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I'm interested to know where is ECIC getting their money? Please forgive me if I ask. I mean, to run this, and perhaps I'm interested to know that you only started in 2001. Perhaps who was doing this before you chipped in? Also, generally, in the there's a feeling that South Africa, rather than concentrating more on Europe in terms of exporting, it sits with a huge market in Africa that perhaps in avoiding all these problems created by the World Trade Organization. That perhaps if we concentrate in Africa, we might improve a lot and we might answer some of the problems Africa is experiencing around, you know, markets and growing our own rather than facing all these tariffs and other conditions laid by WTO. I would want to hear your comment on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Three questions from my side. The first question is, what influenced your decision making as an entity? Is it the profit motive? Is it national interest? Or is it political pressure? Or something else? The second thing is, do I understand correctly that as any other insurance company, the higher the risk, the higher the premiums? Do you work on that basis as well? And then thirdly, the ECIC and its predecessors have been in existence for 50 years. But if I heard you correctly, you said that there have been some recent changes, some recent happenings that changed your landscape and confronted you with new situations. Can you just speak a little bit of this changing landscape and what are the challenges facing you now? Thank you.
Just to Honourable Ngetelana.
Thanks, Ken. Just a few clues. I see one of your core functions is to evaluate, amongst other things, foreign investment risk. As well as credit risk. I've heard sometimes from the bank, banking world, you know, the one that steals your people, that they also do business and financial intelligence, you know, as part of their strategy before they allow investments in various countries. Do you do that as well? It could be very interesting, you know, as part of this investment risk evaluation. That's number one. Number two is that what impact has the international crisis had on the work of the ECIC, and how have you responded to those challenges? Chair, the other one is that whilst I support the fact that we should look at arranging a meeting between the GTI and the National Treasury, I think there's something far broader than this that we need to talk about. It seems Baba Kolo is also looking at some possible legislative changes that may have to be looked into such that ECIC can work in a better environment. It's a baby that's 8 years old now. You know, you are either can claim that you have matured or you're maturing. As a result, it may so happen that the current legislation may not be resonating to your ability to advance and take up things further. My humble submission there, Chair, is that it's better then that there is some elaborate motivation for such a proposal, the broader proposal, maybe for the specific one whereby Treasury doesn't approve or its approvals are dependent on its whims, you know, that can be addressed in the short term. But I'm just emphasizing that what I pick up is seems to be long term, including the issue of saying that you would like now to venture into short term business, because up to now, if I got to is that you've been focusing, or even the legislative arrangement allow you to focus on medium and long term, whereas you feel confident enough. To me, that kind of thing would need a more elaborate motivation so that you can address it. Thanks, Chair.
thank you very much. I do have a couple of questions. One of them is just the explanation on page 67. Just if you can tell us why the bonuses seem to have gone up quite dramatically. Quite a bit, the bonuses, haven't they, page 67, from the previous year. And then, of course, related to that would be the downsizing that was conducted in the organization. I understand what you did is you restructured them downwards, as it were. What were the effects? Were any units negatively affected by this downsizing, as it were? And the other aspect is that the page, 24, you did get, I think it was an unqualified audit, didn't you? Right. But, and the meetings, compared to a number of organizations, are relatively well attended. But I didn't see any reason for Mr. Sharma's poor attendance in some of these meetings. You know, 2 on 1 out of 5 board meetings. And for that matter, also Zanelli. Is it Miss Matlala? 2 there, and I can understand where the people have recently joined. I would have thought that the board meetings were quite important in this regard, especially when they are applicable, and the finance meetings themselves. Is there a particular reason for their non-attendance in that regard? The other aspect is this issue that you have referred to, which the Honourable Njikalana has made some reference to as well. But you've referred to certain recommendations and so on, but you re-emphasized on 2 or 3 occasions the loss of this $500 million and the fact that really you could receive no explanation even from your own the DG of DTI, or it would appear the minister didn't seem to know what the reason for that was. And given the fact that you've re-emphasized it, and the fact that you keep on indicating your contract is coming to an end, I would hope that you would let us know exactly a little bit more clearly what the issue was.
Okay, with regard to the first question as to what degree do the have to do the bilateral treaty and policy framework, first of all, the composition of the board, if you look at it, we have, let me just pull it out, and where was that board? Page 24. Page 24. I just want to run you through on page 24. We have independent members. We have one member from the National Treasury, and we have a member from the DTI. Mr. Sharma is a DTI representative. And then there's Mr. Ritwait, who comes from National Treasury. And then myself, who represents the company on the operational basis. Mr. Sharma looks after the budgeting aspect of it from the DTI, because DTI oversees us and we are subsidiary. And then National Treasury looks at the asset management perspective to make sure that we do not expose the country to more risk than necessary, so that the others don't get. Then the second tier is where our projects are reviewed. There's a credit insurance committee. The credit insurance committee has representatives from the foreign affairs, who that's where the issues of bilateral treaties and all those things are handled from. Then we have a representative from National Treasury, and then we have a representative from the Reserve Bank. The National Treasury is also the same from the department that actually looks after asset management. The Reserve Bank looks after all the foreign exchange regulations and whether we meet all the other aspects. And then the Foreign Affairs looks into seeing whether we can do business in particular areas and what the agency is, you know, those kind of things where they also have to motivate why it's necessary for us to do business. So those are the people that actually guide us on that. And then we do have on the CIC also a representative from the DGI who is in international trade. So all those people are safeguarding and they answer the questions that cover this issue of bilateral treaties. So they have inputs in there. So we are covered in that field. They are the experts that guide us in that. And then the degree of national, how we get ourselves as national players sort of with information, as I said, we do lots of workshops. We do, you know, it may probably be an issue of targeting. We do expert council. We go to provinces, you know, throughout the years. So I my feeling from the question is that probably there's not quite enough that has been done there. And I'll take that as a matter that probably we're not making the inroads we're doing, and I'll look into see how best can we really do that. I take that as something that probably you wouldn't have raised that question if you didn't have that information. So obviously there is a gap there, and I think it is a criticism on our side, and we should accept the fact that maybe we should do more. So I think we probably will try to do more to get, but we're doing the best we can with the resources that we have, and that's no excuse why the whole country does not know. So I'm taking that as a failure on our part. In that respect, maybe we should do a little bit more. I'll take this up with management. I don't think that covers those two. Okay. And where is the ECRC getting their money? The ECRC, when we started, was given 2 billion. We are self-sustaining. We have never, since we got that, that's why I said the minister said today, they gave us that, we said to Metropi, you must never touch that right phone, and we have not touched that right phone. We are a profit-making company, but according to the Bern Union, over the years, over 15 years, we are supposed to break even, because export trade agencies are not supposed to make billions on the back of other people. We shouldn't make money to make other countries poor by giving by doing projects in there. We shouldn't create jobs on the back of other countries so that we can make more money. We can create more jobs on the back of other poor countries. So we do have our own funds. We generate our own funds. We generate funds from premiums. We generate funds from our investments. So we have never asked a cent from government. The interest makeup that we are, it's not ours. It's a transfer to DTI. We manage the IMU on the behalf of like an incentive. So we don't provide incentives. We don't give free money away. So they actually look after that. I mean, we look after it, and we use it for the projects that we do, and we give reports on a quarterly basis to the DTI. And that portfolio is audited by the Auditor General. And then we also have our auditors looking to see that there is a match, that we are not from our end using. So we don't get any money from government except the money they gave us in 2000 when we started. That's point one. Who did business before 2001? We had an arrangement with Credit Guarantee Insurance Corporation. They did the insurance side of things. They did short-term and medium, long-term. And then we had what they call the reserve fund, insurance fund, that looked after the reinsurance. What it means is CGIC did the business, and then we reinsured them for all business, short-term and medium, long-term. But it turns out that also with the arrangement that we made government, when the new government came in, this, I think it was since 58 or so, that CGIC was in operation. So with the new government coming in, and these are one of the things that they looked at, in 2001, it was one of the issues that DTI decided that we have to be able to do things ourselves, because we cannot direct government policy through a private company. And it so turned out also, which was very surprising, that CGIC was owned by the banks, the very clients that we have, that we have to deal with across the table. They fight against the premiums that we charge or the cost that we do, and they want to do the very minimal work. CGIC also, from a weakness that we found, was that because they have two bites at the cherry, when they do the insurance side, they get a commission, 40% insurance. So they're making about 40 million for signing up, and we do all the risk work. And then when projects go wrong and we have to get salvages, they have to get 5% or 10% of that. So whether they do well or whether they do bad, they still got money at the end of it. So they were biting twice. So government decided, but I don't think it was for monetary purposes, or the fact that they could not direct government policy through an agency. They can't force them to do what they wanted. So it was decided that because there's enough appetite, in fact, an international consultant was hired to do the survey. Initially, they had recommended that ECIC should be placed under either the DVSA or the IDC. But it turned out that the mandate conflicted, and secondly, it would have been a conflict also for us to be under IDC. IDC is a client of the EIC. So we decided to set an independent insurance agency, like any other country in the world, except that we don't finance, we only do medium insurance. And the reason why we don't finance also because IDC as a developed finance institution has enough capacity. So if we also finance, I mean, how much money the country got that for us, especially in these tough times, to be running two big funds. So I think it was a good model to use, except that at this point in time, with the changes in the international economic situation, that we need to look at other ways. We can't just sit and look at the same way. You know, you have to start looking and be proactive and also move along with government policy. I think those are the two that concentration in Africa, why not? ECAs by nature are drawn to a particular country. We've got the Australians are tied up to their own area. There's 98% of the projects are in their region because they know the region better. And also people know them. The business will always sort of thrust towards them. In Africa, especially in Southern Africa, nobody wants to go to EFIC in Australia or to the multilateral NIGAR. They tend to want to work with us. And especially with NEFAC, it's our natural partners, Africa, that the majority of us will be inclined to be in Africa if we're in Africa. I could not foresee us having most of our contracts in the UK. And also with the dollar, I mean with the South African rand, which is so weak, is difficult. That's also why we have an IMU to assist us to compete out there. Now, if we put our markets out there, we will not be able to get any projects because the dollar, the people out here, the resources go out in rand. And when the rand goes this way, at the end, when they receive the returns, they find that the rent has gone the other way, and then we have to pay foreign exchange penalties to the exporters because they can't change. They are in rent, whether rent goes up or not. And the higher rent is no good also because it makes them uncompetitive, so it's easier when the rent goes a bit lower that we do much better. And then, of course, there's economic consideration. Is a higher rent good for economy or is a lower, what you call? I mean, I listened to Dr. Davis also complaining about the high rent causing so much problem in the world. So basically, it is you know, natural selection. If you're in Africa, if you're in Europe, you'll be able to. For instance, the British, they have business in the British colony, all British colonies. That's where you see them going out. Barclays Bank, when it took over EFSA has stopped doing business with us.
Yes, could we just try and stick to or focus on responses now because time is totally against us. Totally.
It's not a question that was wrong.
Yes, we're heading off into different examples.
Okay. Thanks, Dr. Sorry, Chester. And then what influences your decision, profit, political, or development? We are meeting filling a market gap in the provision of medium long-term insurance. Now, based as it is, we are dictated by two things. First of all, we need to make a profit. The higher the risk, the higher the premium. And we do risk in a sense that it will make sure it meets with our exposure. That's point one. Point two, we also have to look at the developmental aspects. The process that we do, and this is how we do the risk, and also in our sustainability and our governance, we make sure, as I said, we would not do business in a country where it will maybe a mine will displace people. We refuse to do that. We will not do business when the country is in debt and we burden them with more debt. So that's a developmental aspect. As for whether it's political, I guess you cannot divorce yourself from politics because some of these things have to do with what is the priority of government policy. So in a sense, that's also one country. There is no political. I'll be lying if I said so. There should be, and necessarily so, because as a country, we have a policy that is set by government, and that also has to be looked into. But it's not the primary reason why we. Otherwise, we would not be making the profits we've made throughout the year if we were guided by that in particular. If a project is not good, we will refuse to do it unless where we are told. Because if you look at the Act, if government forces us to do a project, then it must be done under national interest, which means the premiums we collect must be given to the National Treasury, and the claims that come up will go to National Treasury. We have not yet a single project that was called on national interest. So that dispels the issue of political reasons for doing business. There was a question also, changing world economic meltdown. Yes, there is a difficulty right now, though. Everybody has to sit and say, it's not business as usual. We have to start looking to see how do we work towards facing all the difficulties that we have. So we are very selective now in terms of which projects we do, and we change our mechanism. Now, when we started, the flavor of the month was project financing. Now, where everything depended on the resources from the project, but sponsors are not putting enough money into projects, so that is fading off. Now we have to look at new ways. And the Burn Union, with us attending, we get new ways of wanting to see how governments now must take the, you know, isn't that political? Governments from the Burn Union said, must take the lead now in trying to make things much better. They must fund banks, they must do all those things. So it is no more, it's going away from capitalism now to the other side now. But if governments take over banks, then you can't call it capitalism. But that is political interference to be able to do it. The Americans are also doing it, you know. So we are reacting in that particular way to find best ways of helping the promotion of capital goods and exports from South Africa. That is our approach, and we'll continue looking. There is no right question. You just have to do and balance yourself out. Africa, do you do business financial intelligence? Yes, we have a unit that does that precisely. It's called the Credit Policy and Risk Analysis Unit. That really, before anything, when the project comes in, it is sent to, they do country risk analysis. They really go to all sorts. That is how we have the involvement of the Electoral Institute. We do thorough. We don't depend on external information. We use it, but we don't entirely. So we do very thorough analysis within risk profiling. It's called the Credit Policy and Risk Analysis Unit. They do that. That is specialists that do that. We've got actuaries in that department, and we also have economists and financial analysts. So that one definitely we do. What impact has it had on ECIC? I was not quite sure whether I think I wrote what impact it had. Oh, the crisis. Yes, it has. But then we still have a flow of projects still coming in despite, and funny enough, most of them are in Africa. So there is development. I don't think the crisis is going to stop development. Similarly with us here, banks don't have money, but people don't stop eating, people don't stop living. Roads must be built, whether there's money or not. So it is the same with other countries. If they're in turmoil, the first thing you look at is infrastructure. To get a country right is infrastructure. So I don't think that's going to go away. The hotel is difficult. A whole lot of things have to be done to attract tourism. You must change a whole lot of things. So I think even if in bad times, development has to go on. Money will be found somewhere, and that's where we come in. So they will ask us to cover those, and we'll do so. So there's a lot of appetite to fight. I think actually when it gets worse, it's an opportunity. When somebody dies, there's an opportunity for the guy who makes a coffin. So it's the same with us. And then the other thing, that this is the chair. This has to do, that is the question the chair asked, in terms of the restructuring. Yes, I would not say units were negatively affected. The work is still the same. It's just that the job titles were cut down, the responsibilities, and the other people that were doing things were transferred to other. We didn't fire anybody. We took people from one side because, as I explained earlier, we multi-skill. If four people leave in one division, I'm very ready to get two or three. That will take their time until we can bring new people to come in. So all that was done is that we find people were not doing enough. So we did a downsize. But at the end, if one says negatively affected, because some people did resign who did root because they can't change their status of being managers, but we did not affect, it did not affect their salaries. We kept salaries at the same rate. It's just that we increased the workload. You have to do work from other departments to make sure that you can keep yourself in the job. So if you're a manager who did 50% of the work, you'll find 50 from somewhere else, and that's what people didn't like anymore. So I wouldn't say it was negative, because we didn't lose many people with that restructuring. Just that people were downsized in terms of their work and given more work at the lower level. And then the issue of board non-attendance. Mr. Sharma, I think it is also a problem for us. We need to talk to the DTI. Mr. Sharma is a DDG in the DTI, and he's for many times he's always on the road. I have approached the DG so that they can appoint an alternative person, somebody much senior in the field, to be able to attend when Mr. Sharma cannot come in. So we are aware of that, and we have attended to that. In the case of Ms. Matala, she has, yes, we have noted that, we've reported that to the government, but I think that's what has led to her actually not being on the board. She's not on the board since the year end. This was the last appearance at the board. She's no more with us. And then with the IMU issue, The issue of the IMU is a very difficult one that I have engaged the DG. The DG has written, I've got correspondence to prove that he has written to the DG of National Treasury. I don't know, I can't speak for National Treasury, but we have not had any way. We've tried even to get the thing to the minister, and it was also referred back, you know, minister does not want to get involved in operational issues, and there was a transition, how is he going to confront the new minister? So those kind of things happened, and we were left in a very situation where we were fighting with one person, you know, who was, I mean, really, this was not, I don't know, even the DG could not do anything about it, and that is well documented, you know, so, but finally at the end, sense prevailed, and a signature was put, and everything, the door was opened, but that was $500,000 dollar later and a few projects lost. So we hope we'll never get to that. Now, the IMU has been extended for 2 years, so we are bracing ourselves that probably won't face the same person when 2 year comes in for us to sign the new one. Because it has to be renegotiated every 3 years, I think 2 years, with the bank. I hope that answers all my questions, Madam Speaker.
Yes, look, it's just unfortunate that it's now 10 to 1, and we, you know, really just run out of time, and there we do have another item. However, what I want to suggest is that questions that are remain unanswered that we would have put on the table, we send to you in a letter, and that you are able to respond to this by Friday, Monday afternoon at the latest, so that this committee can have sight of it on Tuesday, with today being Wednesday. So we'd appreciate it if, I'm not sure how long you hear this afternoon. You know, are you on a 3 o'clock bus flight?
4 o'clock.
Then you will have time for the committee secretary to make sure you get that, because they're already down and so on. So if we could have that. On another level, I think perhaps other members of the committee had a very clear understanding about this paper, and perhaps they also had a very clear understanding of the impact of the dollar, you know, the functional dollar situation. I must say myself, that's not that clear to me. So what I will do is perhaps just after this meeting obtain your contact numbers, and either myself or the content specialist contact you just to seek more information. So that's more clarification than specific questions in that regard. But thank you very much for your time, and unfortunately, we do have another issue, and I would have wanted to speak to you, but perhaps through the DTI liaison officer, Siraj, I'll be able to get your numbers. And then I do think you should get the number of the Mr. Herman. Thank you very much. Okay. We are very short of the 2 members. He has to come out when we take the decision in the whippery. They'll have to come out for the whippery meeting to come and take that decision. No, he doesn't. But can we get Ferial to go and get him? When we'll be ready to tell him at 1 o'clock to make that decision. Please, can he come back sharp at 1 so we can take the decision? Yes. And then we need one other member, Salcone. And members, just before we move on into the last item, I just want to discuss something with our researcher, Mr. Mashlangu, please. Thank you.